Let me say just a word or two about the book, The Diary of an Old Soul by George MacDonald. I'm going to read some of these sonnets, but I'm not sure how that's going to come off. George MacDonald, I didn't know anything about him until somewhere in the writings of C.S. Lewis, I discovered that Mr. MacDonald had been probably a decisive influence in the return, in Mr. Lewis's return to the faith. He never knew MacDonald. I'm not sure of dates now, but I think MacDonald might have been dead at that time, that he got a hold of his sermons and writings, not just sermons, but writings of various kinds. And Mr. MacDonald, Lewis says, combined law and gospel in a more remarkable or balanced way than any writer that he had ever met or ever seen or read. And he just became fascinated by him, much like a professor I had at Minnesota University, Dr. Swenson, got fascinated and absorbed and captivated by Søren Kierkegaard. So Mr. Lewis seems to have gotten captured by George MacDonald. I think probably if Mary is here, she probably has more data on his life than I do, and we may come back to that. But he was a pastor, and really unacceptable to the congregations or congregation that he served. He had a big family. I think almost a dozen children. You remember Mary?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. And was in abject poverty. But his son, who writes something about him, says that never does he remember his father refusing the children anything. Now that may, you know, he may have had a short memory, but it's more than likely that this was a family in the best meaning of the term, evangelical freedom, a freedom that existed in love. But the fortunes of George MacDonald did turn. He wrote voluminously as sermons and fantasies, just great in fantasies, and poetry. And the bookstore here has a couple volumes of some of his shorter fantasies, stories. And you'd be delighted to read them, I'm sure. But the thing that strikes me is that in the diary, not that he comes to grips with any great theological problems, but the purpose of prayer is obviously to transport you into the presence of God, quite apart from all the cognitive things that might go along. And that's a very intriguing thing. And Mr. Lewis one time, and I think he might have caught that from George MacDonald too, said that obviously the purpose of a worship is not intellectual primarily. It's the object of worship is to transport you into the presence of God. And that's why he quarrels with innovations, by the way, as an Anglican. He doesn't like people tampering with the common service. He at one time said he was all in favor of change in the service. One word every 100 years. He thought what he would like. When I read that, I thought, isn't that true? That which transports me into the presence of God, I think, is something very familiar. A familiar and much loved hymn will do it. And accustomed to a liturgical service, a familiar service will do it. The hymn that you chose didn't do it. I think of praying the Lord's Prayer. I grew up in a church that was a bit hostile toward forms. They didn't like liturgical services. In my early Lutheran upbringing, in fact, they didn't like much form of any kind. The pastor didn't wear any vestments, and the opening prayer was always a free prayer, spontaneous, usually extemporaneous and impromptu, by some deacon whom the pastor would look around and he'd call and say, "Johnson, you open with prayer today." So Johnson got up in the pew and prayed. And that was thought to be better praying than reading a prayer that the church had used for centuries. So that this business of being caught up in the familiar, Mr. Lewis says, is not hostile, is not, against, doesn't minimize or cancel out devotion. And I thought of that with praying the Lord's Prayer. I pray the Lord's Prayer, for instance, as I'm going to sleep at night, I usually preface my prayers with the Lord's Prayer. And I'm about halfway through the prayer before I've even kind of thought about it, because as all of you can, your tongue, your lips can handle it without your brain. And I'm a little ashamed of myself that I seem to come alive on the prayer, "Give us this day our daily bread." And "Thy kingdom come," that may be, secondary, but be sure to make provision for me. But in any event, and I remember a person who entered our congregation by, he'd been brought up in one of the freewheeling denominations, and became a member of our church. And sometime later he said, "Al, I really don't hear your sermon very well." And he said, "By that time in the service, I'm sort of transported into, into the presence of God. And what you say doesn't matter much." And I thought that was probably a great compliment, at least to the liturgy. Probably not to me. But the prayers of George MacDonald in the diary is almost entirely to transport you. It's almost a conversation he has with God. He's asking things to be sure, but it's largely conversing with God. Those of you who have another edition may have read the foreword, how it came to our attention when our son Paul was killed, and the police turned over his billfold to us, and we examined the contents of the billfold. We found three prayers in the sonnet form that he'd written out on a piece of paper and had folded it and put it in his billfold, and from the way it had been folded and unfolded, we assumed that these prayers had meant a great deal to him. And we couldn't, I didn't know where in the world they came from. And then when his books came, and I began to look through his books, then I found this little red book, The Diary of an Old Soul, and found the prayers. And of course, ever since that time, the book has had a good deal of personal investment for Nora and me, and for our family, because obviously it meant a lot to him. And I tried to buy these books. He picked this up secondhand somewhere, and I tried to wrote to England, and I was able to get a few copies, and then finally they said all editions have run out. You can't get any more. And so I got Augsburg Publishing House to publish it. And since all copyright rights were gone, they didn't have to fool around with getting permission from anybody. They simply published it. And then the editions ran out, and then just more recently they published another edition, which you have, don't you? Yeah. Well, I'm going to try to read some of these sonnets, but The fact of the matter is, we haven't been able to use them, really, for family prayers. It's easier to read the Psalms or read some prayers that are more instantly understood. You almost have to be seeped a little into George MacDonald and his language and his thinking. But there's no book that has meant more to me in these last 15, 20 years than this one. And I've been very cheered to having given the book to friends of mine, not my immediate friends in Lutheran circles or anything like that, but a rather scattered group of friends, to discover how much it has meant to them. I've given, at the time, I was in the company of a number of presidents of theological seminaries, and some of them I gave the book to as gift, and the executive director of the Association of Theological Schools, Charles Taylor, became so enamored of it, he said, "Al, it's the best thing that's ever been published. Where can I get copies?" And when the edition ran out, he was clamoring for more, and I had to try to pilfer them from people who probably hadn't been as enamored of George MacDonald. And then I just wrote him at Christmas time and said, your day is made again for a time. They're available, because he was giving them to everybody. And I gave them as a present to each of the members of the faculty. And I remember when Dr. Milton died, our Old Testament professor, had a lingering illness in the hospital. He had his New Testament there. He was an Old Testament scholar, but I suppose the big Bible was a little too heavy to handle. But it was George MacDonald that he said kept him close to God in those last hours or last days. And maybe my reading some of them for a while, and then we can talk. See how that comes off. As I said, I'm a little skeptical on how this is going to come off, but we'll try. I just pick out here and there. I don't think there's a lot of sequence. There's a sonnet for every day of every month, and there is some sequence from, you know, Tuesday to Wednesday to Thursday, but not always. And I never worry about that. When I go to this book, I may start anywhere and just go anywhere. Thy fishes breathe but where thy waters roll. Thy birds fly but within thy airy sea. My soul breathes only in thy infinite soul. I breathe, I think, I love, I live but thee. O breathe, O think, O love, live into me. Unworthy is my life, till all divine, till thou see in me only what is thine. Now let me try something else. He talks about doubt. Doubt swells and surges with swelling doubt behind. You get the picture of Greek tidal wave almost. My soul in storm is but a tattered sail, streaming its ribbons on the torrent gale. In calm, 'tis but a limp and flapping thing. Oh, swell it with thy breath, make it a wing, to sweep through thee the ocean, with thee the wind, nor rest until in thee its haven it shall find. Here are two of the prayers that we found in Paul's things. Not in my fancy now I search to find thee, not in its loftiest forms would shape or bind thee. I cry to one whom I can never know, filling me with an infinite overflow, not to a shape that dwells within my heart, clothed in perfections love and truth assigned thee, but to the God thou knowest that thou art. And this I like especially well. Not, Lord, because I have done well or ill. Not that my mind looks up to thee clear-eyed. And not that it struggles in fast cerements tied. Not that I need thee daily sorer still. Not that I, wretched, wander from thy will. Not now for any cause to thee I cry, but this, that thou art thou, and here am I. I think that's beautiful. Without sorting out any reason at all, you belong to him. But this, that thou art thou, and here am I. And he talks about death coming. Yesterday eve, death came and knocked at my thin door. I from my window looked. The thing I saw, the shape uncouth, I had not seen before. I was disturbed with fear, in sooth, not awe. Whereof ashamed, I instantly did rouse my will to seek thee, only to fear the more. Alas, I could not find thee in the house. I was like Peter when he began to sink. To thee a new prayer therefore I have got, that when death comes in earnest to my door, thou wouldst thyself go when the latch doth clink, and lead him to my room, up to my cot. Then hold thy child's hand, hold and leave him not, till death has done with him forevermore. Beautiful picture. What though my words glance sideways from the thing which I would utter in thine ear, my sire? Truth in the inward parts thou dost desire, wise hunger, not a fitness fine of speech. The little child clamoring fails to reach with upstretched hand the fringe of her attire, yet meets the mother's hand down hurrying. Even when their foolish words they turned on him, he did not his disciples send away. He knew their hearts were foolish, eyes were dim, and therefore by his side needs must they stay. Thou wilt not, Lord, send me away from thee. When I am foolish, make the cock crow grim. If that's not enough, turn, Lord, and look on me. Another day of gloom and slanting rain, of closed skies, cold winds, and blight and bane, such not the weather, Lord, which thou art fain to give thy chosen, sweet to heart and brain. Until we mourn, thou keepest the merry tune. Thy hand unloved its pleasure must restrain, nor spoil both gift and child by lavishing too soon. But all things shall be ours. Up, heart, and sing. All things were made for us. We are God's heirs. Moon, sun, and wildest comets that do trail a crowd of small worlds for a swiftness tail. Up from thy depths in me, my child heart bring. The child alone inherits anything. God's little children, God's, all things are theirs. A great deliverance is a greater thing than purest imagination can foregrasp, a thing beyond all conscious hungering, beyond all hope that makes the poet sing. It takes the clinging world, undoes its clasp, floats it afar upon a mighty sea, and leaves us quiet with love and liberty and thee. O Christ, my life, possess me utterly. Take me and make me a little Christ of me. If I am anything but thy Father's son, to something not yet, from the darkness won. Oh, give me light to live with open eyes. Oh, give me life to hope above all skies. Give me thy spirit to haunt the Father with my cries. Maybe that's the work of the Holy Spirit, to haunt. Give us a chance to haunt the Father. I cannot tell why this day I am ill, but I am well because it is thy will, which is to make me pure and right like thee. Not yet I need escape, 'tis bearable because thou knowest, and when harder things shall rise and gather and overshadow me, I shall have comfort in thy strengthenings. My soul this sermon hence for itself prepares. Then is there nothing vile thou mayst not do, buffeted in a tumult of low prayers and treacheries of the old man against the new. Lord, in my spirit, let thy spirit move, warning that it may not have to reprove. In my dead moments, Master, stir the prayers. Nothing is alien in thy world immense, no look of sky or earth or man or beast. In the great hand of God I stand, and thence look out on life, his endless holy feast. To try to feel is but to court despair, to dig for a sun within a garden fence. Who does thy will, O God? He lives upon thy air. He wasn't very sympathetic with those who were always pursuing some mood. To try to feel is but to court despair, to dig for a sun within a garden fence. Who does thy will, O God? He lives upon thy air. It is thyself, and neither this nor that nor anything told, taught, or dreamed of thee that keeps us live. The holy maid who sat low at thy feet, choosing the better part, is this Mary and Martha story, choosing the better part, rising, bore with her, what a memory, yet brooding only on that treasure, she had soon been roused by a conscious loss of heart. It is thyself, and neither this nor that, nor anything told, taught, or dreamed of thee that keeps us live. Again, it's this idea of being transported into God. O Father, thou art my eternity. Not on the clasp of consciousness, on thee my life depends. And I can well afford all to forget. So thou remember, Lord, in thee I rest. In sleep thou dost me fold. In thee I labor, still in thee grow old. And dying, shall I not in thee my life be bold? Well may this body poor, feebler grow. It is undressing for its last sweet bed. That's what it means when you get aches and pains. But why should the soul, which death can never know, authority and power and memory shed? It is that love which absolute faith would wed. God takes the inmost garments off his child to have him in his arms, naked and undefiled. Reminds me of that story of John Adams, who was asked when he was 80 years old and walking down the street, somebody said, "And how's John Adams today?" And Mr. Adams replied, "John Adams himself is very well, thank you. But the tenement in which he's been living these many years is beginning to show the signs of age, beginning to sag in the corners, and the roof leaks, and when the wind blows, it creaks all over the place." I think John Adams may soon have to find new quarters, but John Adams himself is very well, thank you. And this is the kind of thing. Why should the soul, which death shall never know, surrender or shed authority and power and memory before it meets the regiment? Thou being in me, in my deepest me, through all the time I do not think of thee, shall I not grow at last so true within as to forget thee and yet never sin? Shall I not walk the loud world's busy way, yet in thy palace porch sit all the day, not conscious think of thee, yet never from thee stray? Beautiful. Don't have to be at prayer meetings all day. Be busy. Well, I like this one. Why should it be possible to mistrust, nor possible only, but its opposite, that is to trust, be so hard? Why should not man believe because he must, by sight's compulsion? Why should he be scarred with conflict, worn with doubt fine and long? No man is fit for heaven's musician throng who has not tuned an instrument all shook and jarred. No, that's beautiful. Why shouldn't we be buffeted?
April
6th
one,
please. April 6th?
Uh-huh.
Okay. That's one of my favorite songs. Well, you developed favorites, all right. You lived with this a while. Now, ere I sleep, I wonder what I shall dream. Some sense of being, utter new, may come into my soul while I am blind and dumb, with shapes and airs and scents which dark hours teem, of other sort than those that haunt the day, hinting at precious things, ages away, in the long tale of us God to himself doth say. Beautiful. And this is kind of a picture of being dogged by the law, I think, or by anything that isn't love. Lo, now thy swift dogs, over stone and bush, after me a straying sheep, loud barking rush. There's fear and shame and empty heart and lack and lost love and a thousand at their back. There's fear and shame and empty heart and lack and lost love and a thousand at their bed. I see thee not, but know thou houndest them on. And I'm a lost and I'm lost indeed. Escape is none. See, there they come, down streaming on my track. I rise and run, staggering, double and run, but whither? Whither for escape? The sea lies all about this long-necked cape. And there come the dogs, straight for me every one. Me, live despair, live centers of alarms, and lo, twixt me and all his barking harms, the shepherd. Lo, I run, fall folded in his arms. There let the dogs yelp. Let them growl and leap. It is no matter. I will go to sleep. Like a spent cloud, past pain and grief and fear, out from behind it unchanged, love shines clear. Oh, save me, Christ. I know not what I am. I was thy stupid, self-willed, greedy lamb. I would be thy honest and obedient sheep. Somewhere he's got a statement. What have you a right to demand of God? And he said, you have a right to demand of him that you be pursued by his snarling sheep dogs until there's nothing left but you, nothing, no escape, but to fall into the arms of love, of the love of God. And that's kind of, the law, in a sense. And he has that statement, law is our schoolmaster, our master Christ, lived under all our laws, yet always prayed, so walked the water when the storm was highest. Law is thy father's, that is Christ's father. Thou hast it obeyed, and it thereby subject to thee has made to rule it, master, for thy brethren's sake. Well may he guide the law by whom law's maker makes. So the law is kind of turned over to our Lord. Take from me leisure and all familiar places. Take all the lovely things of earth and air. Take from me books. Take all my precious faces, take words melodious, and their songful linking. Take scents and sounds, and all thy outsides fair, draw nearer taking. And to my sober thinking, thou bringest them nearer all, and ready to my prayer. You know, I give them all to you, and then something happens. You take them and bring them closer to me than they've ever been before. Pardon?
August 16th. The idea that...
You read it.
No, I sound so hoarse. And don't hear you better. But when I think about this, and I think of the fact that, you know, is it Augustine that says that the tragedy of man is that he expects so little.
Expects so little
of life, the little of God.
Good one. I do not wonder men can ill believe who make poor claims upon thee, perfect Lord. Then most I trust, when most I would receive. I wonder not that such do pray and grieve. The God they think to be God is not fit. Then only in thy glory I seem to sit. When my heart claims from thine an infinite accord. Very good. I like this one too. We are all lonely, Maker, each a soul shut in by itself, a sundered atom of thee. No two yet love themselves into a whole. Even when we weep together, we are two. Of two to make one, which yet two shall be, is thy creation's problem, deep and true, to which thou only holdest the happy, hurting clue. No less than thou, O Father, do we need a God to friend each lonely one of us. That is, we'll never get away from loneliness in a profound sense except in God. As touch not the sack two grains of sand or two grains of seed, touch no two hearts in great world's populace. Outside the making God, we cannot meet him. He has made our brother. Homeward thus, to find our kin, we first must turn our wandering feet. We've got to go home to get each other. I suppose it's a profound picture of what the communion of saints really deep down should be. It must be possible that the soul made should absolutely meet the soul that makes. Then in that bearing soul, meet every other. They're also born, each sister and each brother. Lord, till I meet thee thus, life is delayed. I am not I until that morning breaks, not I until my consciousness eternal wakes. And he had a couple passages about his two children that have died. Again, that's that eternal morning, again I shall behold thee, daughter, true. The hour will come when I shall hold thee fast in God's name, loving thee all through and through. Somewhere in his grand thought, this waits for us. Then shall I see a smile not like thy last. For the great thing which came when all was past, was not a smile, but God's peace, glorious. And I applied this, I suppose his son was a little younger than mine. Twilight and transfiguration joy, gleam-faced, pure-eyed, strong-willed, high-hearted boy, hardly thy life clear forth of heaven was sent, ere it broke out into a smile and went. So swift thy growth, so true thy goalward bent, thou, child and sage, inextricably blent, will one day teach thy father in some heavenly tent. Well, I think the from these sonnets you understand why they have to be lived with before they you get a lot of books of prayers that will help you instantly, but I don't think these will help except they be lived with, but they're worth living with because he's got such superb gift of poetry and you know the notes that are sounded are so genuine, so true to both Christian teaching and Christian experience that they deserve to be used. Mary, you probably have some things to add, George.
No, I think that was a really good selection. I think it's the kind of thing that you have to read yourself. I mean, you can get a sort of a taste of it from Al's, you know, selection and his reading. But they are, as he said, they're something you live with, and I don't like them all equally well. I think some of them are sentimental.
Yeah.
And kind of drippy, but you know that doesn't mean that the rest of them aren't good.
No.
And it might be me that doesn't, you know, identify right there. Mm. But I didn't, you know, you don't have to take it like the catechism or or the scriptures. It's like any prayer book or book of devotions or anything. They meet you in different moods and ways, and I certainly has been a great help to me and Paul, Alan Norris' son, had the book with him when he spent Christmas with us when he was at Oxford, and I was so amazed at it. I felt just like Al did, and I sat down and copied. I think I copied about 10 or 12 of these little, you know, poems and prayers, and he said, "Well, Mary, you know, I'm sure I can find one for you over there in England." So when he went back, he sent me a copy, like Al's. I think it's a red one, real old one. And it's really been such it's really been a blessing. And I guess I think one thing that it does for you is it makes you grow as you read, because your own life grows in the process of this conversation. It really does. It really does a lot.
It is conversation. It is, of course, they're prayers for the most part, but they're kind of prayers. And as if he's talking to someone he knows pretty well. And maybe that's why it's attractive. It sort of lifts you off the earth. You won't have many prayers for world peace and for economic justice and those things in this volume. But I suppose George MacDonald would say, well, that can come afterwards, as long as you get thoroughly integrated with God, then these other things can come. But it is a sense, in a sense, he lifts you off and makes you meet God. And our son Steve asked Nora and me one time after he'd read the book, said, why do you suppose Paul was attracted to that book? Because Paul was a very active person. Now, I think Steve was asking, do you suppose he had a premonition that he wasn't going to live long? And I don't think so. I think any person, any age, would be attracted to this as he lived with it. And it wouldn't say, well, the diary of an old soul, you'd figure, well, since I'm getting older, I better, you know, find out what old people should be involved with. But I think this is as germane to one age as to another.
Would you read, before you close your book, would you read that, the one from the 31st of December? Because that, you know, it's
well, the last one.
What he gave to his children and sort of,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Go, my beloved children, live your life. Wounded, faint, bleeding, never yield to strife. Stunned, fallen, awake, arise, and fight again. Before you, victory stands with shining train of hopes not credible until they are. Beyond morass and mountain swells the star of perfect love, the home of longing heart and brain. And I, in that little foreword, I made some little apology for the fact that that his poetry may not be the best. Or I didn't put it exactly that way, but I think I was. I think Mr. Lewis said something about that too. And that kind of enraged Charlie Taylor. Old Testament professor, this Episcopalian, who executive director of the American Association of Theological Schools, he said, Al, that's good poetry. Don't say that in your foreword, that it's poor poetry. Or I didn't call it poor, but I echoed the judgment of C.S. Lewis in the little foreword. See, he was over here lecturing, wasn't he, Mary?
Yes, he was. In fact, his office is a very plummy church in New York City. Big, to a big salary.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it wasn't Lutheran.
Well, he must have been Presbyterian, wasn't he?
Well, yeah, he was, but he wasn't really very...
No,
he wasn't
of course.
A Calvinist, so he wasn't
no.
Really accepted.
No. They didn't
never
keep him.
The right thing.
They didn't keep him on very long. But his Paul picked up other books by MacDonald. Most of them these fantasies, stories, and usually stories of not exactly fairy tales, but stories that had well something like that whole crowd writes stories. C.S. Lewis and Charles Williams, and they are lovely stories. And then there's a little book that C.S. Lewis put out of short paragraphs taken from various writings of George MacDonald, 300-400 paragraphs, and that's out of print.
You say you can't buy this book now.
Yes, you can buy it.
In the bookstore.
In the bookstore.
Here?
There's a bookstore here, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because you don't get all the good out of it with one reading.
Oh, no.
You've got to read it yourself.
Right.
It sounds nice when somebody else reads it, but you get more sense out of it if you do read it yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Figure it out.
That's right. Well, it's an age when we need very much, I think, to nestle back in some great love, like he is instrumental in having us do. Because doubts and fears and all of these things are assail us. And you know, Mr. Lewis, or maybe it's his son, who says that in spite of the poverty and in spite of the sensitivity to the that which isn't good and fears and all, that this person was, what do they say, a merry, gay, or mirth, had a, was a person of mirth. And that's wonderful to know too, that you, that this reflects the state of a person who in spite of the difficulties rides along on a note of gladness. I don't feel that it's an escape when I read that, as I often do, maybe before I go to sleep. Just pick it up and read a few of these. Sometimes I get caught and keep reading. And I've read them over and over. And I don't think it's an escape. I suppose to read some book with all kinds of problems to solve would seem to be more with it. This transports you into the presence of God, but it doesn't leave you irresponsible for the world. But at least it helps you nestle there and put this as a vantage point. Well, I think there's a popcorn contest on, so we'll call it the end.